Neuromancer by William Gibson. Continued. Cassette 2, Side 1. Lots of forces types wound up cops, I mean. Or corporate security, Case added uncomfortably. Molly handed him a steaming mug of coffee. That number you had them do on my pancreas, that's like a cop routine. Armitage closed the door and crossed the room to stand in front of Case. You're a lucky boy, Case. You should thank me. Should I? Case blew noisily on his coffee. You needed a new pancreas. The one we bought for you frees you from a dangerous dependency. Well, thanks, but I was enjoying that dependency. Good, because you have a new one. How's that? Case looked up from his coffee. Armitage was smiling. You have 15 toxin sacs bonded to the lining of various main arteries, Case. They're dissolving. Very slowly, but they definitely are dissolving. Each one contains a mycotoxin. You're already familiar with the effect of that mycotoxin. It was the one your former employers gave you in Memphis. Case blinked up at the smiling mask. You have time to do what I'm hiring you for, Case, but that's all. Do the job, and I can inject you with an enzyme that will dissolve the bond without opening the sacs. Then you'll need a blood change. Otherwise, the sacs melt, and you're back where I found you. So you see, Case, you need us. You need us as badly as you did when we scraped you up from the gutter. Case looked at Molly. She shrugged. Now go down to the freight elevator and bring up the cases you find there. Armitage handed him the magnetic key. Go on. You'll enjoy this, Case. Like Christmas morning. Summer in the sprawl. The mall crowds swaying like wind-blown grass. A field of flesh shot through with sudden eddies of need and gratification. He sat beside Molly in filtered sunlight on the rim of a dry concrete fountain, letting the endless stream of faces recapitulate the stages of his life. First a child with hooded eyes, a street boy, hands relaxed and ready at his sides. Then a teenager, face smooth and cryptic beneath red glasses. Case remembered fighting on a rooftop at 17, silent combat in the rose glow of the dawn geodesics. He shifted on the concrete, feeling it rough and cool through the thin black denim. Nothing here like the electric dance of Ninsei. This was different commerce, a different rhythm, in the smell of fast food and perfume and fresh summer sweat. With his deck waiting back in the loft, an Ono Sendai Cyberspace 7. They'd left the place littered with the abstract white forms of the foam packing units, with crumpled plastic film and hundreds of tiny foam beads. The Ono Sendai, next year's most expensive Hosaka computer. A Sony monitor, a dozen discs of corporate-grade ice, a Braun coffee maker. Armitage had only waited for Case's approval of each piece. Where'd he go? Case had asked Molly. He likes hotels, big ones, near airports if he can manage it. Let's go down to the street. She zipped herself into an old surplus vest with a dozen oddly shaped pockets and put on a huge pair of black plastic sunglasses that completely covered her mirrored insets. You know about that toxin shit before? He asked her by the fountain. She shook her head. You think it's true? Maybe, maybe not. Works either way. You know any way I can find out? No, she said, her right hand coming up to form the jive for silence. That kind of kink's too subtle to show up on a scan. Then her fingers moved again. Wait. And you don't care that much anyway. I saw you stroking that Sendai, man. It was pornographic. She laughed. So, what's he got on you? How's he got the working girl kinked? Professional pride, baby, that's all. And again, the sign for silence. We're going to get some breakfast, okay? Eggs, real bacon. Probably kill you. You've been eating that rebuilt Chiba krill for so long. Yeah, come on. We'll tube into Manhattan and get us a real breakfast. Lifeless neon spelled out Metro Holographics in dusty capitals of glass tubing. Case picked at a shred of bacon that had lodged between his front teeth. He'd given up asking her where they were going and why. Jabs in the ribs and the sign for silence were all he'd gotten in reply. She talked about the season's fashions, about sports, about a political scandal in California he'd never heard of. He looked around the deserted dead-end street. A sheet of newsprint went cartwheeling past the intersection. Freak winds in the east side, something to do with convection, and an overlap in the domes. Case peered through the window at the dead sign. Her sprawl wasn't his sprawl, he decided. She'd led him through a dozen bars and clubs he'd never seen before, taking care of business, usually with no more than a nod, maintaining connections. Something was moving in the shadows behind Metro Holographics. The door was a sheet of corrugated roofing. In front of it, Molly's hands flowed through an intricate sequence of jive that he couldn't follow. He caught the sign for cash, a thumb brushing the tip of the forefinger. The door swung inward, and she led him into the smell of dust. They stood in a clearing, dense tangles of junk rising on either side, to walls lined with shelves of crumbling paperbacks. The junk looked like something that had grown there, a fungus of twisted metal and plastic. He could pick out individual objects, but then they seemed to blur back into the mass. The guts of a television so old it was studded with the glass stumps of vacuum tubes, a crumpled dish antenna, a brown fiber canister stuffed with corroded lengths of alloy tubing. An enormous pile of old magazines had cascaded into the open area, flesh of lost summers staring blindly up as he followed her back through a narrow canyon of impacted scrap. He heard the door close behind them. He didn't look back. The tunnel ended with an ancient army blanket tacked across a doorway. White light flooded out as Molly ducked past it. Four square walls of blank white plastic, ceiling to match, floored with white hospital tile, molded in a non-slip pattern of small raised discs. In the center stood a square, white-painted wooden table and four white folding chairs. The man who stood blinking now in the doorway behind them, the blanket draping one shoulder like a cape, seemed to have been designed in a wind tunnel. His ears were very small, plastered flat against his narrow skull, and his large front teeth, revealed in something that wasn't quite a smile, were canted sharply backward. He wore an ancient tweed jacket and held a handgun of some kind in his left hand. He peered at them, blinked, and dropped the gun into a jacket pocket. He gestured to Case, pointed at a slab of white plastic that leaned near the doorway. Case crossed to it and saw that it was a solid sandwich of circuitry, nearly a centimeter thick. He helped the man lift it and position it in the doorway. Quick, nicotine-stained fingers secured it with a white Velcro border. A hidden exhaust fan began to purr.
"Time," the man said, straightening up, "and counting. You know the rate, Maul.
We need a scan, Finn, for implants.
So get over there between the pylons. Stand on the tape. Straighten up, yeah. Now turn around. Give me a full 360.
Case watched her rotate between the two fragile-looking stands studded with sensors. The man took a small monitor from his pocket and squinted at it.
"Something new in your head, yeah. Silicon, coat of pyrolytic carbons. A clock, right? Your glasses give me the read they always have. Low-temp isotropic carbons. Better biocompatibility with pyrolytics, but that's your business, right? Same with your claws.
Get over here, Case." He saw a scuffed X in black on the white floor.
"Turn around, slow. Guy's a virgin."
The man shrugged.
"Some cheap dental work is all."
"You read for biologicals?" Molly unzipped her green vest and took off the dark glasses.
"You think this is the Mayo? Climb on the table, kid. We'll run a little biopsy."
He laughed, showing more of his yellow teeth.
"Nah, Finn's word, sweet meat. You got no little bugs, no cortex bombs. You want me to shut the screen down?"
"Just for as long as it takes you to leave, Finn. Then we'll want full screen for as long as we want it."
"Hey, that's fine by the fin, Maul. You're only paying by the second."
They sealed the door behind him, and Molly turned one of the white chairs around and sat on it, chin resting on crossed forearms.
"We talk now. This is as private as I can afford."
"What about?"
"What we're doing."
"What are we doing?"
"Working for Armitage."
"And you're saying this isn't for his benefit?"
"Yeah.
I saw your profile, Case, and I've seen the rest of our shopping list once. You ever work with the dead?"
"No."
He watched his reflection in her glasses. I could, I guess. I'm good at what I do. The present tense made him nervous. You know that the Dixie Flatline's dead? He nodded. Hart, I heard. You'll be working with his construct, she smiled. Taught you the ropes, huh? Him and Quine. I know Quine, by the way. Real asshole. Somebody's got a recording of McCoy Polly? Who? Now Case sat and rested his elbows on the table. I can't see it. He'd never have sat still for it. SenseNet. Paid him mega, you bet your ass. Quine dead, too? No such luck. He's in Europe. He doesn't come into this. Well, if we can get the flat line, we're home free. He was the best. You know he died brain death 3 times? She nodded. Flatlined on his EEG. Showed me tapes. Boy, I was dead. Look, Case, I've been trying to suss out who it is backing Armitage since I signed on, but it doesn't feel like a Zaibatsu, a government, or some Yakuza subsidiary. Armitage gets orders. Like something tells him to go off to Chiba, pick up a pillhead who's making one last wobble through the burnout belt, and trade a program for the operation that'll fix him up. We could have bought 20 world-class cowboys for what the market was ready to pay for that surgical program. You were good, but not that good. She scratched the side of her nose. Obviously makes sense to somebody, he said. Somebody big. Don't let me hurt your feelings. She grinned. We're going to be pulling one hardcore run, Case, just to get the Flatline's construct. SenseNet has it locked in a library vault uptown, tighter than an eel's ass, Case. Now, SenseNet, they got all their new material for the fall season locked in there, too. Steal that and we'd be richer than shit. But no, we gotta get us the Flatline and nothing else. Weird. Yeah, it's all weird. You're weird, this hole's weird, and who's the weird little gopher outside in the hall? Finn's an old connection of mine. Fence, mostly. Software. This privacy biz is a sideline. But I got Armitage to let him be our tech here, so when he shows up later, you never saw him. Got it? So what's Armitage got dissolving inside you? I'm an easy make. She smiled. Anybody any good at what they do, that's what they are, right? You got a jack, I got a tussle. He stared at her. So tell me what you know about Armitage. For starters, nobody named Armitage took part in any screaming fist. I checked. But that doesn't mean much. He doesn't look like any of the pics of the guys who got out. She shrugged. Big deal. And starters is all I got. She drummed her nails on the back of the chair. But you are a cowboy, aren't you? I mean, maybe you could have a little look around? She smiled. He'd kill me. Maybe, maybe not. I think he needs you, Case, and real bad. Besides, you're a clever John, no? You can winkle him, sure. What else is on that list you mentioned? Toys, mostly for you. And one certified psychopath name of Peter Riviera. Real ugly customer. Where's he? Don't know, but he's one sick fuck, no lie. I saw his profile. She made a face. God awful. She stood up and stretched, cat-like. So we got an axis going, boy? We're together in this? Partners? Case looked at her. I got a lot of choice, huh? She laughed. You got it, cowboy. The Matrix has its roots in primitive arcade games, said the voiceover. In early graphics programs and military experimentation with cranial jacks. On the Sony, a two-dimensional space war faded behind a forest of mathematically generated ferns, demonstrating the spatial possibilities of logarithmic spirals. Cold blue military footage burned through, lab animals wired into test systems, helmets feeding into fire control circuits of tanks and warplanes. Cyberspace, a consensual hallucination experienced daily by billions of legitimate operators in every nation, by children being taught mathematical concepts, a graphic representation of data abstracted from the banks of every computer in the human system. Unthinkable complexity, lines of light ranged in the non-space of the mind, clusters and constellations of data, like city lights receding. What's that? Molly asked as he flipped the channel selector. Kids show. a discontinuous flood of images as the selector cycled. "Off," he said to the Hosaka. "You want to try now, Case?" "Wednesday. 8 days from waking in cheap hotel with Molly beside him. You want me to go out, Case? Maybe easier for you alone." He shook his head. "Nah, stay. Doesn't matter." He settled the black terry sweatband across his forehead, careful not to disturb the flat Sendai dermatrodes. He stared at the deck on his lap, not really seeing it, seeing instead the shop window on Ninsei, the chromed shuriken burning with reflected neon. He glanced up. On the wall, just above the Sony, he'd hung her gift, tacking it there with a yellow-headed drawing pin through the hole at its center. He closed his eyes, found the rigid face of the power stud, and in the blood-lit dark behind his eyes, silver phosphenes boiling in from the edge of space, hypnagogic images jerking past like film compiled from random frames, symbols, figures, faces, a blurred, fragmented mandala of visual information. "Please," he prayed, "now." A gray disk the color of Chiba sky. "Now." Disk beginning to rotate, faster, becoming a sphere of paler gray. Expanding. And flowed, flowered for him. Fluid neon origami trick. The unfolding of his distanceless home, his country. Transparent 3D chessboard extending to infinity. Inner eye opening to the stepped scarlet pyramid of the Eastern Seaboard Fission Authority, burning beyond the green cubes of Mitsubishi Bank of America, and high and very far away he saw the spiral arms of military systems forever beyond his reach. And somewhere he was laughing, in a white-painted loft, distant fingers caressing the deck, tears of release streaking his face. Molly was gone when he took the trodes off, and the loft was dark. He checked the time. He'd been in cyberspace for 5 hours. He carried the Ono Sendai to one of the new work tables and collapsed across the bed slab, pulling Molly's black silk sleeping bag over his head. The security package taped to the steel fire door bleeped twice. "Entry requested," it said. "Subject is cleared per my program. So open it." Case pulled the silk from his face and sat up as the door opened, expecting to see Molly or Armitage. "Christ," said a hoarse voice. "I know that bitch can see in the dark." A squat figure stepped in and closed the door. "Turn the lights on, okay?" Case scrambled off the slab and found the old-fashioned switch. "I'm the Finn," said the Finn, and made a warning face at Case. "Case, pleased to meet you, I'm sure. I'm doing some hardware for your boss, it looks like." The Finn fished a pack of partagas from a pocket and lit one. The smell of Cuban tobacco filled the room. He crossed to the work table and glanced at the Ono Sendai. "Looks stock. Soon fix that. But here's your problem, kid." He took a filthy manila envelope from inside his jacket, flicked ash on the floor, and extracted a featureless black rectangle from the envelope. "Goddamn factory prototypes," he said, tossing the thing down on the table. "Cast them into a block of polycarbon. Can't get in with a laser without frying the works. Booby-trapped for X-ray, ultrascan, God knows what else. We'll get in, but there's no rest for the wicked, right?" He folded the envelope with great care and tucked it away in an inside pocket. "What is it?" "It's a flip-flop switch, basically. Wire it into your Sendai here. You can access live or recorded SimStim without having to jack out of the Matrix." "What for?" "I haven't got a clue. No, I'm fitting Maul for a broadcast rig, though, so it's probably her sensorium you'll access." The Finn scratched his chin. "So, now you get to find out just how tight those jeans really are, huh?" Chapter 4. Case sat in the loft with the dermatrodes strapped across his forehead, watching motes dance in the diluted sunlight that filtered through the grid overhead. A countdown was in progress in one corner of the monitor screen. Cowboys didn't get into SimStim, he thought, because it was basically a meat toy. He knew that the trodes he used and the little plastic tiara dangling from a SimStim deck were basically the same, and that the cyberspace matrix was actually a drastic simplification of the human sensorium, at least in terms of presentation, but SimStim itself struck him as a gratuitous multiplication of flesh input. The commercial stuff was edited, of course, so that if Tally Isham got a headache in the course of a segment, you didn't feel it. The screen bleeped a 2-second warning. The new switch was patched into his Sendai with a thin ribbon of fiber optics. And one, and two, and... Cyberspace slid into existence from the cardinal points. Smooth, he thought, but not smooth enough. Have to work on it. Then he keyed the new switch. The abrupt jolt into other flesh. Matrix gone, a wave of sound and color. She was moving through a crowded street, past stalls vending discount software, prices felt penned on sheets of plastic, fragments of music from countless speakers, smells of urine, free monomers, perfume, patties of frying krill. For a few frightened seconds, he fought helplessly to control her body. Then he willed himself into passivity, became the passenger behind her eyes. The glasses didn't seem to cut down the sunlight at all. He wondered if the built-in amps compensated automatically. Blue alphanumerics winked the time, low in her left peripheral field. Showing off, he thought. Her body language was disorienting, her style foreign. She seemed continually on the verge of colliding with someone, but people melted out of her way, stepped sideways, made room. "How you doing, Case?" He heard the words and felt her form them. She slid a hand into her jacket, a fingertip circling a nipple under warm silk. The sensation made him catch his breath. She laughed, but the link was one way. He had no way to reply. 2 blocks later, she was threading the outskirts of Memory Lane. Case kept trying to jerk her eyes toward landmarks he would have used to find his way. He began to find the passivity of the situation irritating. The transition to cyberspace, when he hit the switch, was instantaneous. He punched himself down a wall of primitive ice belonging to the New York Public Library, automatically counting potential windows, keying back into her sensorium, into the sinuous flow of muscle, senses sharp and bright. He found himself wondering about the mind he shared these sensations with. What did he know about her? That she was another professional? That she said her being, like his, was the thing she did to make a living. He knew the way she'd moved against him earlier, when she woke, their mutual grunt of unity when he'd entered her, and that she liked her coffee black afterward. Her destination was one of the dubious software rental complexes that lined Memory Lane. There was a stillness, a hush. Booths lined a central hall. The clientele were young, few of them out of their teens. They all seemed to have carbon sockets planted behind the left ear, but she didn't focus on them. The counters that fronted the booths displayed hundreds of slivers of Microsoft, angular fragments of colored silicon mounted under oblong, transparent bubbles on squares of white cardboard. Molly went to the 7th booth along the south wall. Behind the counter, a boy with a shaven head stared vacantly into space, a dozen spikes of Microsoft protruding from the socket behind his ear. "Larry, you in, man?" She positioned herself in front of him. The boy's eyes focused. He sat up in his chair and pried a bright magenta splinter from his socket with a dirty thumbnail. "Hey, Larry." "Molly," he nodded. "I have some work for some of your friends, Larry." Larry took a flat plastic case from the pocket of his red sports shirt and flicked it open, slotting the Microsoft beside a dozen others. His hand hovered, selected a glossy black chip that was slightly longer than the rest, and inserted it smoothly into his head. His eyes narrowed. "Molly's got a rider," he said, "and Larry doesn't like that." "Hey," she said, "I didn't know you were so sensitive. I'm impressed. Costs a lot to get that sensitive." "I know you, lady." The blank look returned. "You looking to buy some softs?" "I'm looking for the moderns." "You got a rider, Molly, this says." He tapped the black splinter. "Somebody else using your eyes." "My partner." "Tell your partner to go." "Got something for the Panther moderns, Larry." "What are you talking about, lady?" "Case, you take off," she said. And he hit the switch, instantly back into the matrix. Ghost impressions of the software complex hung for a few seconds in the buzzing calm of cyberspace. "Panther Moderns," he said to the Hosaka, removing the trodes. "5 minute précis." "Ready," the computer said. It wasn't a name he knew. Something new, something that had come in since he'd been in Chiba. Fads swept the youth of the sprawl at the speed of light. Entire subcultures could rise overnight, thrive for a dozen weeks, and then vanish utterly. "Go," he said. The Hosaka had accessed its array of libraries, journals, and news services. The précis began with a long hold on a color still that Case at first assumed was a collage of some kind. A boy's face snipped from another image and glued to a photograph of a paint-scrawled wall. Dark eyes, epicanthic folds, obviously the result of surgery, an angry dusting of acne across pale, narrow cheeks. The Hosaka released the freeze. The boy moved, flowing with the sinister grace of a mime pretending to be a jungle predator. His body was nearly invisible, an abstract pattern approximating the scribbled brickwork sliding smoothly across his tight one-piece, mimetic polycarbon. Cut to Dr. Virginia Rambali, sociology, NYU. Her name, faculty, and school pulsing across the screen in pink alphanumerics. "Given their penchant for these random acts of surreal violence," someone said, "it may be difficult for our viewers to understand why you continue to insist that this phenomenon isn't a form of terrorism." Dr. Rambali smiled. "There is always a point at which the terrorist ceases to manipulate the media gestalt, a point at which the violence may well escalate, but beyond which the terrorist has become symptomatic of the media gestalt itself. Terrorism, as we ordinarily understand it, is innately media-related. The Panther Moderns differ from other terrorists precisely in their degree of self-consciousness, in their awareness of the extent to which media divorce the act of terrorism from the original socio-political intent." "Skip it," Case said. Case met his first Modern 2 days after he'd screened the Hosaka's précis. The Moderns, he'd decided, were a contemporary version of the big scientists of his own late teens. There was a kind of ghostly teenage DNA at work in the sprawl, something that carried the coded precepts of various short-lived subcults and replicated them at odd intervals. The Panther Moderns were a soft-head variant on the scientists. If the technology had been available, the big scientists would all have had sockets stuffed with Microsofts. It was the style that mattered, and the style was the same. The Moderns were mercenaries, practical jokers, nihilistic techno-fetishists. The one who showed up at the loft door with a box of diskettes from the Finn was a soft-voiced boy called Angelo. His face was a simple graft grown on collagen and shark cartilage polysaccharides, smooth and hideous. It was one of the nastiest pieces of elective surgery Case had ever seen. When Angelo smiled, revealing the razor-sharp canines of some large animal, Case was actually relieved. Toothbud transplants. He'd seen that before. "You can't let the little prick's generation gap you," Molly said. Case nodded, absorbed in the patterns of the SenseNet ice. This was it. This was what he was, who he was, his being. He forgot to eat. Molly left cartons of rice and foam trays of sushi on the corner of the long table. Sometimes he resented having to leave the deck to use the chemical toilet they'd set up in a corner of the loft. Ice patterns formed and reformed on the screen as he probed for gaps, skirted the most obvious traps, and mapped the route he'd take through SenseNet's ice. It was good ice, wonderful ice. Its patterns burned there while he lay with his arm under Molly's shoulders, watching the red dawn through the steel grid of the skylight. Its rainbow pixel maze was the first thing he saw when he woke. He'd go straight to the deck, not bothering to dress, and jack in. He was cutting it. He was working. He lost track of days. And sometimes, falling asleep, particularly when Molly was off on one of her reconnaissance trips with her rented cadre of Moderns, images of Chiba came flooding back. Faces in Ninsei neon. Once he woke from a confused dream of Linda Lee, unable to recall who she was or what she'd ever meant to him. When he did remember, he jacked in and worked for 9 straight hours. The cutting of SenseNet's ice took a total of 9 days. "I said a week," Armitage said, unable to conceal his satisfaction when Case showed him his plan for the run. "You took your own good time."
"Balls," Case said, smiling at the screen. "That's good work, Armitage."
"Yes," Armitage admitted, "but don't let it go to your head. Compared to what you'll eventually be up against, this is an arcade toy."
"Love you, Cat Mother," whispered the Panther Modern's link man. His voice was modulated static in Case's headset. "Atlanta, Brood, looks go. Go, got it?"
Molly's voice was slightly clearer.
"To hear is to obey."
The Moderns were using some kind of chicken wire dish in New Jersey to bounce the link man's scrambled signal off a Sons of Christ the King satellite in geosynchronous orbit above Manhattan. They chose to regard the entire operation as an elaborate private joke, and their choice of commsats seemed to have been deliberate. Molly's signals were being beamed up from a 1-meter umbrella dish epoxied to the roof of a black glass bank tower nearly as tall as the SenseNet building. Atlanta. The recognition code was simple. Atlanta to Boston to Chicago to Denver. 5 minutes for each city. If anyone managed to intercept Molly, unscramble it, synth her voice, the code would tip the Moderns. If she remained in the building for more than 20 minutes, it was highly unlikely she'd be coming out at all. Case gulped the last of his coffee, settled the trodes in place, and scratched his chest beneath his black T-shirt. He had only a vague idea of what the Panther Moderns planned as a diversion for the SenseNet security people. His job was to make sure the intrusion program he'd written would link with the SenseNet systems when Molly needed it to. He watched the countdown in the corner of the screen. 2, 1. He jacked in and triggered his program.
"Mainline," breathed the link man, his voice the only sound as Case plunged through the glowing strata of SenseNet ice.
"Good. Check Molly." He hit the simstim and flipped into her sensorium. The scrambler blurred the visual input slightly. She stood before a wall of gold-flecked mirror in the building's vast white lobby, chewing gum, apparently fascinated by her own reflection. Aside from the huge pair of sunglasses concealing her mirrored insets, she managed to look remarkably like she belonged there, another tourist girl hoping for a glimpse of Tally Isham. She wore a pink plastic raincoat, a white mesh top, loose white pants cut in a style that had been fashionable in Tokyo the previous year. She grinned vacantly and popped her gum. Case felt like laughing. He could feel the micropore tape across her rib cage, feel the flat little units under it, the radio, the simstim unit, and the scrambler. The throat mic, glued to her neck, looked as much as possible like an analgesic dermadisc. Her hands, in the pockets of the pink coat, were flexing systematically through a series of tension-release exercises. It took him a few seconds to realize that the peculiar sensation at the tips of her fingers was caused by the blades as they were partially extruded, then retracted. He flipped back. His program had reached the fifth gate. He watched as his icebreaker strobed and shifted in front of him, only faintly aware of his hands playing across the deck, making minor adjustments. Translucent planes of color shuffled like a trick deck. Take a card, he thought. Any card. The gate blurred past. He laughed. The SenseNet ice had accepted his entry as a routine transfer from the consortium's Los Angeles complex. He was inside. Behind him, viral subprograms peeled off, meshing with the gate's code fabric, ready to deflect the real Los Angeles data when it arrived. He flipped again. Molly was strolling past the enormous circular reception desk at the rear of the lobby. 12:01:20 as the readout flared in her optic nerve. At midnight, synced with the chip behind Molly's eye, the link man in Jersey had given his command.
Mainline.
9 Moderns, scattered along 200 miles of the sprawl, had simultaneously dialed Max Emerge from payphones. Each Modern delivered a short set speech, hung up, and drifted out into the night, peeling off surgical gloves. 9 different police departments and public security agencies were absorbing the information that an obscure subsect of militant Christian fundamentalists had just taken credit for having introduced clinical levels of an outlawed psychoactive agent known as Blue Nine into the ventilation system of the SenseNet pyramid. Blue Nine, known in California as Grievous Angel, had been shown to produce acute paranoia and homicidal psychosis in 85% of experimental subjects. Case hit the switch as his program surged through the gates of the subsystem that controlled security for the SenseNet Research Library. He found himself stepping into an elevator. "Excuse me, but are you an employee?" The guard raised his eyebrows. Molly popped her gum. "No," she said, driving the first 2 knuckles of her right hand into the man's solar plexus. As he doubled over, clawing for the beeper on his belt, she slammed his head sideways against the wall of the elevator. Chewing a little more rapidly now, she touched closed door and stop on the illuminated panel. She took a black box from her coat pocket and inserted a lead in the keyhole of the lock that secured the panel's circuitry. The Panther Moderns allowed 4 minutes for their first move to take effect, then injected a second, carefully prepared dose of misinformation. This time, they shot it directly into the SenseNet building's internal video system. At 12:04:03, every screen in the building strobed for 18 seconds in a frequency that produced seizures in a susceptible segment of SenseNet employees. Then something only vaguely like a human face filled the screens, its features stretched across asymmetrical expanses of bone like some obscene Mercator projection. Blue lips parted wetly as the twisted, elongated jaw moved. Something, perhaps a hand, a thing like a reddish clump of gnarled roots, fumbled toward the camera, blurred, and vanished. Subliminally rapid images of contamination, graphics of the building's water supply system, gloved hands manipulating laboratory glassware, something tumbling down into darkness, a pale splash. The audio track, its pitch adjusted to run at just less than twice the standard playback speed, was part of a month-old newscast detailing potential military uses of a substance known as HSG, a biochemical governing the human skeletal growth factor. Overdoses of HSG threw certain bone cells into overdrive, accelerating growth by factors as high as 1,000%. At 12:05, the mirror-sheathed nexus of the SenseNet Consortium held just over 3,000 employees. At 5 minutes after midnight, as the Modern's message ended in a flare of white screen, the SenseNet pyramid screamed. 6 NYPD tactical hovercraft, responding to the possibility of Blue Nine in the building's ventilation system, were converging on the SenseNet pyramid. They were running full riot lights. A Bama Rapid Deployment helicopter was lifting off from its pad on Rikers. Case triggered his second program. A carefully engineered virus attacked the code fabric, screening primary custodial commands for the sub-basement that housed the SenseNet research materials.
"Boston," Molly's voice came across the link. "I'm downstairs."
Case switched and saw the blank wall of the elevator. She was unzipping the white pants. A bulky packet, exactly the shade of her pale ankle, was secured there with micropore. She knelt and peeled the tape away. Streaks of burgundy flickered across the mimetic polycarbon as she unfolded the Modern suit. She removed the pink raincoat, threw it down beside the white pants, and began to pull the suit on over the white mesh top. 12:06:26. Case's virus had bored a window through the library's command ice. He punched himself through and found an infinite blue space ranged with color-coded spheres strung on a tight grid of pale blue neon. In the non-space of the matrix, the interior of a given data construct possessed unlimited subjective dimension. A child's toy calculator, accessed through Case's Sendai, would have presented limitless gulfs of nothingness hung with a few basic commands. Case began to key the sequence the Finn had purchased from a mid-echelon Saturday man with severe drug problems. He began to glide through the spheres as if he were on invisible tracks. Here, this one.
punching his way into the sphere, chill blue neon vault above him, starless and smooth as frosted glass, he triggered a sub-program that affected certain alterations in the core custodial commands. Out now, reversing smoothly, the virus re-knitting the fabric of the window. Done. In the SenseNet lobby, two Panther Moderns sat alertly behind a low rectangular planter, taping the riot with a video camera. They both wore chameleon suits. Tacticals are spraying foam barricades now, one noted, speaking for the benefit of his throat mic. Rapids are still trying to land their copter. Case hit the SimStim switch and flipped into the agony of broken bone. Molly was braced against the blank, gray wall of a long corridor, her breath coming ragged and uneven. Case was back in the Matrix instantly, a white-hot line of pain fading in his left thigh. "What's happening, Brood?" he asked the link man.
"I don't know, Cutter. Mother's not talking. Wait."
Case's program was cycling. A single hair-fine thread of crimson neon extended from the center of the restored window to the shifting outline of his icebreaker. He didn't have time to wait. Taking a deep breath, he flipped again. Molly took a single step, trying to support her weight on the corridor wall. In the loft, Case groaned. The second step took her over an outstretched arm. Uniform sleeve, bright with fresh blood. Glimpse of shattered fiberglass shock stave. Her vision seemed to have narrowed to a tunnel. With the third step, Case screamed and found himself back in the Matrix.
"Brood? Boston, baby."
Her voice tight with pain, she coughed.
"Little problem with the natives. Think one of them broke my leg."
"What you need now, Cat Mother?"
The link man's voice was indistinct, nearly lost behind static. Case forced himself to flip back. She was leaning against the wall, taking all of her weight on her right leg. She fumbled through the contents of the suit's kangaroo pocket and withdrew a sheet of plastic studded with a rainbow of dermadiscs. She selected three and thumbed them hard against her left wrist over the veins. 6,000 micrograms of endorphin analog came down on the pain like a hammer, shattering it. Her back arched convulsively. Pink waves of warmth lapped up her thighs. She sighed and slowly relaxed.
"Okay, Brood. Okay now, but I'll need a medical team when I come out. Tell my people. Cutter, I'm 2 minutes from target. Can you hold?"
"Tell her I'm in and holding," Case said. Molly began to limp down the corridor. When she glanced back once, Case saw the crumpled bodies of three SenseNet security guards. One of them seemed to have no eyes.
"Tacticals and rapids have sealed the ground floor, Cat Mother. Foam barricades. Lobby's getting juicy."
"Pretty juicy down here," she said, swinging herself through a pair of gray steel doors. "Almost there, Cutter."
Case flipped into the Matrix and pulled the trodes from his forehead. He was drenched with sweat. He wiped his forehead with a towel, took a quick sip of water from the bicycle bottle beside the Hosaka, and checked the map of the library displayed on the screen. A pulsing red cursor crept through the outline of a doorway, only millimeters from the green dot that indicated the location of the Dixie Flatlines construct. He wondered what it was doing to her leg to walk on it that way. With enough endorphin analog, she could walk on a pair of bloody stumps. He tightened the nylon harness that held him in the chair and replaced the trodes. Routine now. Trodes, jack, and flip. The SenseNet Research Library was a dead storage area. The materials stored here had to be physically removed before they could be interfaced. Molly hobbled between rows of identical gray lockers.
"Tell her 5 more and 10 to her left, Brood," Case said. 5 more and 10 left, Cat Mother," the link man said.
She took the left. A white-faced librarian cowered between two lockers, her cheeks wet, eyes blank. Molly ignored her. Case wondered what the moderns had done to provoke that level of terror. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.